Hello, this is the weekly On Science podcast. Welcome to the NPR Science Desk. We're bringing you our weekly roundup of interesting stories. I'm Christopher Joyce, and with me this week is my editor, Allison Richards. Welcome.
Hi, well, thanks for asking me. This is a bit of a change for me. I usually am very noisy behind the scenes, but...
Well, you've got something to tell us about climate change to start off for our weekly podcast.
Yeah, we have a story this week which isn't all bad news, so that makes a great change.
I'm glad to hear that. Richard Harris is the deliverer of the semi-good news. He covers climate change for the desk quite a bit, and he talked to a couple of scientists who seem to think we're going about this solving the climate crisis in the wrong way. Let's hear what he's got to say.
Dan Sarewitz is an unassuming, slightly rumpled scientist who works out of an unassuming, slightly scruffy office in Washington, D.C. He runs an outfit called the Consortium for Science Policy and Outcomes, based at Arizona State University. And he's trying to figure out a better way to change the way the world uses energy.
This is really the metabolism of modern industrial society, our use of energy. And changing that system is not about replacing a few technologies or advancing our level of efficiency along certain fronts.
It means creating a whole new basis for the global economy. Sarewitz is skeptical that politicians can deliberately manage a transformation of that scale, either through legislation or through climate treaties. He says, for starters, measures that will ultimately force everyone to pay more for energy are doomed, both economically and politically.
Politically, what you're asking people to do is to pay a huge upfront cost for benefits many decades down the road that they can't even anticipate or predict. And that is politically an extremely difficult sort of situation to manage.
Harder still, considering that Americans rank global warming at the bottom of their worry list, according to a January poll by the Pew Research Center for People and the Press. And even if the public became passionate about climate change, Sarewitz says it's hard to imagine how they would warm to the idea of making carbon-emitting fuels prohibitively expensive. Just try to imagine how much that would cost.
The economic dislocation that would be created by getting to that sort of level would absolutely be immense. And it's easy to be casual about that, or it's easy to pin that kind of argument on conservative Republicans or on the executives of oil corporations. But nevertheless, it is absolutely true that you would be talking about something that would be completely destabilizing to global economies.
Okay, enough of the bad news. Sarewitz isn't a naysayer or a cynic, but he has been trying to think of another way to deal with climate change. To do that, he's looked back in history to see how we managed other major transformations. One example is agriculture. The United States government created a highly successful century-long effort to make food more abundant and affordable.
And it didn't do so by setting any particular target or timetable. It did so by investing in research, in development, and in very importantly, in institutions.
For example, the Agricultural Extension Service, which brought together researchers to tackle the big problems and farmers to put the solutions to work quickly. The key to all of it was speeding up innovation. And the good news is none of this required an ugly political or public debate. That's the model Sarewitz would like to use for climate change.
The idea really is to take the political heat off of climate change and instead move this into the realm of policy wonkdom, where many, many small decisions made across many agencies, many types of policies, many domains, set the conditions for moving in the right direction without demanding that people accept that this is the most important problem in the world.
Sarewitz is now hard at work trying to identify what institutions we need to drive that transformation in the coming decades. The ultimate goal is to make renewable energy about as cheap as fossil fuels. Otherwise, there's little hope that the nations of the world will agree to tackle climate change. Sarewitz knows the Obama administration won't abandon its current path to craft climate laws and a treaty.
But there's no reason why they can't at the same time, and I'm hopeful that they will at the same time, understand that the real action is going to be on the innovation front.
And he adds, there's no time to lose. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Well, Richard, I didn't edit this piece, so these are really real questions from me. And it might be because I'm Brit, so don't know about these American things, but what did the Agricultural Extension Service do? Because understanding that seems to be key to understanding this guy's vision.
That's true. And what it does is it created a whole network of institutions. It's not necessarily product-oriented, but it's sort of institutions that could help move ideas along. And so what it really did was it married the American university system with the American farmers by creating an institution where they could get together. The academics could come out and do research or suggest ways of improving crops, and then the farmers could see what was going on and say, oh, that sounds like a good idea, and they could bring it out onto the farms.
Now, I've got this vision. These farmers, you know, in their Wellington boots or whatever, what, with a moldy carrot going up to the research center and saying, is there a better way to grow carrots so that I get a better yield and don't get these nasty worms? Or did the big scientists go out to the farms and say, well, I think you could do a bit better here? I mean, how did it work?
I think it's still going on today, but I think it's more the latter, actually. I think farmers, like most of us, find something that works and they kind of stick with it. And what it takes is a little nudge to say, hey, did you know that, you know, maybe you'd have a higher yield or you'd have fewer moldy strawberries if you tried this other approach? And let's you know, sometimes it takes place on a farmland that doesn't belong to a farmer but is a research farmland. And they say, when we grew those strawberries, take a look at these, you know, and do you want strawberries? Strawberries look like these, and if the farmers say yes, then it's sort of they're hooked in.
So the idea here seems to be that we should do this with energy.
Yes.
I wonder if Stephen Chu, coming from academia and a Nobel Prize winner, being the head of the Department of Energy, is something along the same lines, bringing that bank of knowledge from universities and academics out into the real world.
And Department of Energy labs like the ones that he ran, absolutely. And that's been a tough slog because there have been lots of people with tons and tons of ideas, many of them maybe not quite ready for prime time, but some of them ready to be nudged along a little bit. It's not just the idea of doing research and development and researching new ideas and sort of exploring new ideas. It's the really tough business of getting those ideas actually out into the marketplace. And it doesn't just mean better windmills, although that could be part of it, or better solar panels, which we hope will be part of it also. But it maybe means really thinking organically and very differently about how the entire infrastructure of energy in this country is put together. Part of the problem in discussing this is that it becomes very abstract, because if you ask somebody at the beginning of the agricultural, in the early days of all this agricultural work to say, where are we heading with this? Person would say, I don't really know, because it takes on a life of its own. So when I asked Dan Sarewitz, so what institutions would you create? He said, well, I'm still even thinking about that. But the point is, it's not a predictable path of saying this is where we're going to be and this is how we're going to get there. It's a sense of creating institutions that could make things work and then letting things happen.
Thanks very much, Richard. That's great.
Oh, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
You might want to. Is it really changing the old model of R&D, of research and development? It's saying, okay, we've got some ideas in the lab here that with energy could work in the real world, and let's make a leap out and see whether it get people, real people, involved in trying to use some of these things and seeing whether it works.
Yeah, I think what it is, in some ways, the emphasis is off of research and development and onto the new buzzword, which is innovation, which is how to make the best use of research and development. And that means moving it along, and that's very, very tricky to do. But that's what they're trying to solve. That's the problem they're trying to solve.
Well, we should get Al Gore, since he invented the internet. Maybe he can invent a way out of climate change.
He's trying.
Thanks very much, Richard.
Okay, my pleasure.
Well, Chris, you do reporting on climate change as well, and you have a taste for things extinct, especially large extinct things. But anyway, both of them came together this week in one of the stories that you did, right?
Yes, a school bus-sized item that was discovered in Colombia in South America. I have to give it away. I would love to keep it for the end as a punchline, but yes, a 42-foot-long snake that used to exist. And it used to exist because of a climate that was somewhat similar to the climate we might face in the future. So I ended up talking to one of the scientists who identified it, who told an interesting tale not only of the snake, but of ancient climate. So we can hear that now.
If you must.
It's tempting to wait till the end of this story to reveal that this snake is extinct. But that wouldn't be fair. So, okay, Titanoboa sarahonensis lived 60 million years ago. But one can still imagine, as big around as a trash barrel, weighing over a ton. Jason Head is a paleontologist at the University of Toronto who studies big snakes that once roamed the earth, or slithered, that is. A colleague in Columbia, South America, called and said he'd found some huge bones from a very long spinal column. They set up a video conference so Head could see them.
He held one specimen up to the camera, and I just about jumped out of my chair. And we were both just sitting there laughing because it was so ridiculously big. It was a vertebra the size of his hand. You know, we were both just blown away. And I said, I know this is the world's largest snake.
Titanoboa inherited the Earth after the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago.
Between the end of the age of dinosaurs and about 45, give or take a couple million years, this is the single largest terrestrial vertebrate.
On land, Titanoboa was boss. It ate, well, whatever it wanted. Most meals were primitive crocodiles, al dente. But Head says size isn't the whole story here.
We realized right away that it was telling us a story, that the fact that there is a snake this big has to mean something about the environment.
Something about how hot the tropics were then, and maybe how hot they could get again. Here's why. This snake was presumably cold-blooded. To survive with that big a body, it had to live in a very hot place. To be exact, says Head, a rainforest averaging 32 degrees Celsius, more or less, or 90 degrees Fahrenheit. That's several degrees warmer than now, and several degrees warmer than scientists thought the tropics could ever get, even during a greenhouse period.
There's an old idea that the tropical regions have a thermostat, and they just can't get hotter than about 28, 29, 30 degrees C.
That's Matthew Huber, who studies ancient climates at Purdue University. Essentially, the idea has been that the tropics just don't warm up that much during global warming periods, even as the rest of the world does. Huber says the snake evidence suggests otherwise.
And if that's the case, that's in some sense bad news for us for the future. It says there's no magical thermostat that keeps the tropics at a reasonable temperature that they will warm to in a global warming world.
If, he says, that is the case. No one has ever used a fossil snake before as a measure of ancient climate. Huber says the work will need some confirmation. But, he adds, there might also be a bright side here. Many biologists thought that tropical forests would simply die if they got significantly hotter.
And this suggests that at least on long-time scales, the tropics are quite happy to be significantly warmer than they are today.
Though if the tropics do get warmer, don't expect a reappearance of Titanoboa-sized snakes. They'll remain a scientific curiosity, described in this week's issue of the journal Nature. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Well, shame there'll never be a snake like that again. But there's a picture on the website, isn't there?
There is a picture. It's an artist rendering. Of course, there's no way to find a picture of the actual animal, although the vertebrae are pretty amazing. But if you go to the website, you can see what an artist thinks the snake would have looked like.
I have to say, one thing about working on the science desk is you can't get bored. I mean, I've worked on snakes, climate, and this week I also worked with one of the reporters, John Hamilton. He likes to do pieces about brains. And this week there was a new study from some Canadian researchers showing how colour affects our brains, in fact, how colour affects the way we think. And it boils down to something like this. And this was John's phrase. Details are red, concepts are blue.
And violets?
I don't think we got to violet.
Well, let's hear what we did get to.
You may have missed this, but the field of colour and cognition research has been in turmoil. Color scientists, and there are more than you might think, have clashed over which hues are best for improving mental performance. Some studies say red, others blue. Now, a team from the University of British Columbia has a study that claims to reconcile these contradictory findings. It's just been published online by the journal Science. Ravi Mehta, the lead author, says take the color red.
Red color makes you pay more attention to details and enhances your performance on detailed tasks, whereas blue makes you focus on more creative aspects and enhances your performance on creative tasks.
Mehta says red triggers what's called an avoidance response in the brain. Avoid mistakes, don't take risks. Blue encourages an approach response. Relax, be open to new concepts. That conclusion comes from research on more than 600 people. Mehta had them do stuff like solve anagrams or design a child's toy. One test had people respond to advertising copy for two fictional brands of toothpaste. The first brand was promoted as a way to prevent cavities, in other words, avoid risk. The second promised to make your teeth whiter, a prospect full of possibility. Meta says people read the descriptions on a screen with a background that was either red, blue, or white.
Significantly more people in red color choose the brand which was good on cavity prevention, whereas significantly more number of people in blue condition choose the product which was better on teeth whitening.
People who got the white background had no preference. Meta says the results explain previous conflicting results about how red and blue affect thinking. Either color can provide an advantage, but only for the right kind of task. Meta says the new findings aren't just academic. They have implications for everyday activities.
When you're filing your tax returns, you should actually have, you know, your computer screen set at red color.
Especially if you might be nominated to run, say, a large federal agency. Scientists who study colors praise the new research. Marcus Meyer from SUNY Stony Brook says it explains a study he did in which people saw either red or a neutral color before taking an IQ test, which requires creative thinking.
And what we found is that those who have briefly seen the red color, they did worse in the IQ test, verbal or numeric IQ test, than those in the control color conditions.
Red made them stupid.
In other words, you could say red made them stupid. You're right.
Actually, it made them worry about mistakes when they should have been thinking outside the box. But Meyer says the new research doesn't resolve all questions about red and blue. For example, there's that study about how color affects men's perception of women.
If the color red is involved, these women are perceived to be more attractive, more sexually desirable than in any control color condition.
So maybe red doesn't always trigger an avoidance response. And Nancy Stone from Missouri University of Science and Technology says the new research may be hard to apply to real-world decisions, like whether to paint a library red or blue.
If you really dislike reading or aren't very good at it, would that be an approach task for you, or might it be an avoidance task?
Which may be why off-white remains so popular. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Well, I certainly find off-white to be very peaceful. I don't have a library in my home, but if I did, I think I'd have it off-white. Anyway, that was interesting and also part of a trend, I think, in this week's coverage, because we're going to stick with color for a moment. Allison got to work with Robert Krowich on a story about color of people.
Yeah, it was a complete coincidence, but Robert came up this week with an extraordinary story about skin color, because it turns out, you know, whatever color you are, or your grandparents are, or were, you don't have to go back very far in your family tree to find out that you were once a very different hue.
I think Robert called this, "Your family may once have been a different color." Let's hear it.
According to Penn State anthropologist Nina Jablonski, it now appears that most humans on our planet come from families that, if you go back not that many generations,
almost all of us were in a different place and we had a different color.
You may be as white as milk today or as black as deep chocolate, and yet your direct ancestors, and not because of intermarriage, as recently as 100 generations ago, and that's not far back.
No, it's not far, really. It isn't far at all.
Your direct ancestors could have had a very different color than you.
Our original estimates were that this occurred perhaps at a more stately pace, but now we think that that process of change may have had to occur much more quickly.
And here's why. As everybody knows, says Nina,
humans started in Africa.
The part of Africa near the equator where it's intensely sunny with lots and lots of ultraviolet light, which was a problem because ultraviolet light not only can cause sunburn, when you get too much of it,
your connective tissues will break down and get very saggy and wrinkly, but perhaps even more importantly, the UV radiation will cause skin cancer.
And skin cancer can sometimes kill you. On the other hand, if a human is plopped down, say, in Norway, where the days can be very short and there's precious little ultraviolet light, then you discover there's a benefit to UV light.
And that is that it helps to initiate the process of producing vitamin D in the skin. Vitamin D helps us absorb calcium, and we need calcium to build a skeleton, to maintain a strong immune system, and for a host of other important functions in the body.
So back when our earliest hominid ancestors were walking around Central Africa, in order to survive, we had to figure out a way to screen ultraviolet light so we didn't die of cancer. But when humans then start to move away from the equator, then we had to get enough UV to build bones, stay healthy.
This is where evolution absolutely is at its peak.
Because humans need skin that could adjust to changes in light, and so nature provided, says Nina.
An absolutely remarkable pigment called melanin.
Melanin is produced by genes.
To balance the need to have sunscreen built in versus the need to be able to still produce some vitamin D in the skin. So it's a really cool molecule.
And how does this molecule change skin color? Well, Darwin teaches that these things begin randomly. Somebody at some point had a baby, and that baby just by chance has a little change in its DNA, which makes the baby's skin, let's say, a little lighter. So now, when that baby moves north to Europe as a grown-up, her light skin is an advantage because it helps her stay stronger, gives her more vitamin D, and so, says Nina,
as they moved slowly northward, those generally that had the lighter pigmentation would have survived and reproduced preferentially.
Meaning lighter-skinned people start to produce more babies than dark-skinned people.
That's really the bottom line.
Producing more babies means you can survive as a group, and the further north you go, the better it is to have lighter skin.
Because by the time you get to Lapland, boy, there's precious little UV in the sunshine, and there's precious little sunshine during the whole year.
And that is why, as you approach the Arctic, you do find more and more light-skinned people.
And so this, in short, really creates the gradation of skin color that we see in modern humans today.
And I didn't know this, but there are also instances of lighter groups turning darker over time.
The people now living in southern parts of India are extremely darkly pigmented.
But once upon a time, those same people lived in Central Asia, and up north there, they were much lighter until they moved south, where new evidence suggests
they re-evolved dark pigment.
And they're not the only ones. Aboriginal Australians may have gone from light to dark. Pacific Islanders, the same.
There's probably been a re-darkening of several different groups of humans.
How would you know that? You don't have any photograph of their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpas and grandmas.
Oh, but I have their genetic photograph.
Meaning scientists have now studied the genes, the DNA, of populations all over the world.
What we can do in modern humans is isolate the genes that are responsible for pigmentation in most groups, and then, knowing the position of these genes in the genome, look at the pieces of DNA that we have isolated from some ancient ancestors and see how they compare.
And by comparing DNA in ancient samples, they can very closely estimate when changes take place.
You can look backwards and see different generations of different colors. It's just phenomenal. But let's take that even farther.
If you assume that each generation lasts 25 years, say, give or take,
yes.
It turns out that if a group of people keeps moving north or south to find food or to avoid enemies, to keep moving, that group needs to keep changing color at a remarkable pace.
We might be thinking, let's say, 50 to 100 generations.
Wait. 50 to 100 generations? That's times 25. That's 2,500 years. You're saying that in 2,500 years, a lineage, a family group, can go from being black to being white or back the other way? I mean, that is lightning fast. That's like ancient Greece to now. I mean, that's like...
Yes, it's remarkable.
But there is a caveat, she says.
We're talking about the rate of change during the earliest parts of human evolution, when we would not have had the nice togas or clothing that the man in Greece may have had.
Because once people put on clothes covering the skin, then the rate of change does slow down. So it's when we were naked and moving. That's when skin colors changed very quickly. But still, this means that this thing that we all notice when we think about race, skin color, it's not fixed at all. It is remarkably fluid.
We have now some fascinating genetic evidence of evolution acting on the skin, the intensity of natural selection. We think that process of change may have had to occur much more quickly.
Much, much, much more quickly. I'm Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Ah, The ever more wonderful world of evolution, huh?
Isn't it evolution?
Oh, I'm sorry. Evolution. I mean, no.
If you're going to live in this country, let's stick with one pronunciation, okay? Let's make a deal.
Okay. The wonders of evolution, huh?
Well, whichever way you want to pronounce it, evolution is a big topic because next week there is a big, important birthday.
Yes. February the 12th is Darwin's 200th. Birthday, or maybe you stop having birthdays when you're dead and it becomes an anniversary, I suppose. But anyway, yes. And then later this year, we're also celebrating the publication of his revolutionary book on the origin of species. So this is going to be a big year for Darwin. And we started celebrating early on NPR.
Yes. Leanne Hansen, who is one of the hosts at NPR at Weekend Edition Sunday, spoke with Keith Thompson, an author who's written a book about what Charles Darwin was like as a child.
This month, Weekend Edition Sunday and NPR Science Desk will explore how Charles Darwin's work has affected both science and society. But first, it helps to understand the man himself, where he came from, what shaped him, who influenced him, and how he became the most influential naturalist ever. Keith Thompson is Professor Emeritus of Natural History at the University of Oxford and has written extensively about Darwin. In his latest book, The Young Charles Darwin, he describes what the scientist was like as a child.
He was very self-absorbed. He did a huge amount of reading. He liked to go for long walks by himself when he would get so absorbed in thinking that he might fall off a wall or something like that. And he hated school.
He hated school.
What he loved was learning things for himself. But if someone sat up and told him, here are the 20 rules that you have to understand, then he blanked out.
I have to ask you, why was he nicknamed Gas as a kid?
Oh, because he and his older brother Erasmus were terribly keen on chemistry experiments, which they did in a shed in the garden. And one of the things if you're going to do chemistry, you have to make smelly gases.
Who in his family tree would you say most influenced his scientific tendencies?
I think very much his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who is a very famous doctor in the English Midlands. He was also the first person to write down a theory of what we now call evolution. Of course, it's long since superseded by his grandson, but it was quite shattering at the time and rather unpopular.
Charles Darwin's mother died when he was eight years old. And I understand she was an inveterate gardener.
She was, yes. They had greenhouses, and the botanical world then was still reeling under the influence of the work of Carl Linnaeus in Sweden, who had produced a classificatory scheme of plants which depended on looking at their reproductive parts. And for people in the late 18th century, this was really quite scandalous that you'd be talking about the male parts and the female parts and so on. Darwin's grandfather had wrote a whole book around this called The Loves of Plants. And there is a letter which suggests that Susanna Darwin had sat Darwin down at a young age and explained to him what the bits of the flower were. And this is how far it got, I don't know. But she does seem to have been a most remarkable woman and very interested in not just the pretty parts of plants, but the scientific aspects of botany too.
He went to Edinburgh to study.
He was shipped off to Edinburgh at the age of 16 because he was doing so poorly in the formal schooling.
Really? But Edinburgh was pretty much a hub of scientific thinking at that time.
It was, and it was a wonderful place for him to have been. What he discovered there, I think, though, is that he was very, very interested in the science, particularly the natural history. But he didn't like it when people got to arguing and fussing about one interpretation versus another. That turned him off.
So there were already debates about, say, natural selection, how the Earth was formed, how old the Earth is there. And he didn't pay attention to them, or did they influence him?
It's very hard to tell from his letters and his autobiography. Natural selection was his invention, so that came later. But Edinburgh in 1827 and 1828 was quite a hotbed of people talking about evolution. They were talking about his grandfather's theory. and it had recently been revived and extended by Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck in France, and we refer to his ideas as Lamarckism. And one of Darwin's mentors there published some very strongly Lamarckian essays at the time Darwin was there. So it was really kind of a hot issue at the moment.
Why did he decide to study theology at Cambridge?
Most people will tell you that he saw a couple of nasty operations in his first year as medical school at Edinburgh and without chloroform, and they really turned him off. My view is that what happened, he got in with this Dr. Grant, who was a very good naturalist who took him everywhere, and they started doing work together in the laboratory. Darwin made some nice little discoveries, and Grant published them without acknowledging that even Darwin had had anything to do with it. Under that betrayal, Darwin just gave up Edinburgh and went home. Well, the next possible career would be to go into the church, and so he went to Cambridge to study to do a bachelor's degree in classics and theology preparatory to becoming a Church of England parson.
Why didn't he continue on that path?
Well, two things. His older brother Erasmus had worked out that they were going to be very well off. His mother, who was a Wedgwood, had left a large fortune. Their father had a great deal of money, and that they wouldn't actually have to work. And so I'm sure that his original plan was that he would have a sort of nominal church somewhere that he was nominally responsible for and then become a sort of dilettante natural historian. But then he was invited to go on the voyage of HMS Beagle, and he became a great scientist instead. And he never had to earn a penny, never did have a job.
When he was invited aboard the HMS Beagle, why did he want to go? What was his goal?
He was a terribly keen naturalist. He loved to collect animals, insects particularly, loved to collect plants. And here was this extraordinary opportunity, a ship that would be going around the world for two, as it was then thought, finished up nearly 5 years. But it had one tremendous advantage for him, and that is that the captain, Robert Fitzroy, wanted someone to go on this voyage who would be a gentleman and would be something of a companion for him. And so it was socially acceptable, and it was everything he'd ever dreamt of. And also, it managed to put off making any decisions about his career in the church.
You write that when Darwin started the voyage on the Beagle, he was a conventional Christian. Do you think he had inner conflicts about science and religion?
Yes. Later in his life, it was a terrible problem. He realized what his theory, which provided a mechanism for evolution. People had long thought that evolution must have happened, but if you didn't have a mechanism, you couldn't take it very seriously. He provided a serious mechanism, and he knew by doing that he would really set the cat among the pigeons. He wrote to a friend that before he had made any of this public, he said, "It's like confessing a murder." And it was made worse by the fact that his wife, Emma, was a very devout woman, and she was really badly hurt by anything he said that doubted the existence and power of the Creator. So for all his life, he had to deal with the problem of what he was doing and what the effect it would have, particularly on his wife and family.
What were his strengths, would you say, as a scientist?
Oh, very easy, that one. I think, one, his total self-absorption. Nothing interfered with his work. Secondly, he was a voluminous reader. He just inhaled information from books. And he often read and worked and thought until he made himself physically ill. But on top of that, he had a particular sort of brilliance. He could take three or four different phenomena and see associations among them that nobody else had ever spotted before, this associative reasoning. Some scientists are very good at taking a fact and then making a smaller fact and a smaller fact until they go right down to one little nubbin of truth. He was exactly the opposite. He could take material from anywhere and bring it together and make one all-encompassing theory.
Keith Thompson is the author of The Young Charles Darwin.
Now, in that segment from Leanne, you probably noticed science correspondent Joe Palka talking about knitters and quilters in England who are celebrating Darwin in their own very special way. Well, you'll be hearing more from Joe next week, because next week is the Darwin Birthday Week, and he'll be reporting from England on all sorts of festivities going on there and hoping to throw some light on how Darwin came to revolutionise biology.
Thanks, Alison, and thank you, folks, for listening to this week's On Science podcast. We'd love to hear from you, by the way. So drop us a line at nprscience@npr.org. Tell us what you like. You can tell us what you don't like, too. Again, that's nprscience, all one word, @npr.org. Thanks again for listening. I'm Christopher Joyce.
And I'm Alison Richards.